It's Friday, June 18th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, Tough Questions, we review the week in free speech with Pen America's own Suzanne Nossel. We discuss the splintering of the internet as countries assert their so-called digital sovereignty, today's elections in Iran, and the debate over teaching divisive topics on campus. Then, a conversation about Crimea, Ukraine, and the condition of minority rights in the occupied peninsula. We talk to a top Ukrainian government official about the complex issues confronting Ukrainian Crimea 7 years since the occupation began. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. It's time for Tough Questions, a weekly segment where we turn to Pen America CEO Suzanne Nossel to answer some of the toughest questions about free speech from the past week. And Suzanne joins me now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi there.
So, Suzanne, this week we put out a report on the ways that Russia and Myanmar and Belarus and other authoritarian countries are increasingly putting up new barriers to a free and open internet. And the thing that I found most interesting was that we also showed how ostensible democracies like Nigeria and India may also be sliding in that direction, all in the name of something called digital sovereignty. What does that mean? And how does it represent a threat to free expression?
Sure. Well, the notion of sovereignty in the analog world is, of course, the idea that within your own borders, a legitimate government has control and decisive authority and should not be questioned or challenged on how they govern. So sovereignty disputes come up, for example, in relation to mass scale human rights violations and the question of whether the international community can intervene, or would that be a violation of sovereignty? Or when a government makes an incursion across a border, invades their neighbor, it's a violation of sovereignty. So that's the traditional concept. In the digital arena, of course, in cyberspace, there are no borders. The internet is global, at least in its kind of original conception and form. And so information, communications move around without reference to these national boundaries. And at first, in sort of the halcyon days of the internet, this was recognized as, you know, a wonderful boon to freedom of speech and connectivity and kind of flowering of all sorts of networks that could rise up in this digital realm with sort of the geographic distance effectively collapsed. And of course, what's happened, unsurprisingly, over time is that governments have realized that this sort of universality of cyberspace in many ways can pose a kind of encroachment on the sovereignty and dominion that they're accustomed to wielding within their borders. Because of course, you know, for example, an idea that would be censored or banned in a given country, if it were printed in a paper, newspaper, or a book, you know, may well enter in and gain ahead of steam and go viral on social media. And so countries have now for a long time asserted their own rules and laws and insisted that global platforms like a Google or a Facebook or a Twitter adhere to those laws. They write to those firms, they tell them to take down content that violates local law. And the platforms do that because it's a condition to being able to operate within these jurisdictions. If they don't follow local law, they can and sometimes do get shut out entirely. And what our report documents really is a sort of intensifying of this trend to a new level of an assertion of cyber sovereignty and a determination on the part of many countries, both authoritarian and increasingly democratic countries, to assert and extend their sovereignty to the digital realm. So, for example, insisting that not only that local law be adhered to, but that companies maintain local staff within the jurisdiction so that if those laws are violated, they have somebody they can arrest and imprison, insisting that data be located within countries. So, for example, if they want to uncover, you know, the origins of a post that is seen in some way seditious or threatening to the government, that they have the ability to obtain that data. They can requisition it and assert their legal dominion to force the companies to comply, and a whole range of other measures that really have the potential and already are undercutting this global quality of the internet and run the risk of, you know, we call this the report splintered speech, but a real kind of balkanization of the internet where the rules are different in each place. What you see and don't see differs vastly. Your ability to transmit and connect across boundaries is severely challenged. And so, yeah, we examine that. It's sort of more complicated than it looks because there are also assertions of digital sovereignty sort of on the side of enforcement of human rights and countries that are insisting that the way that internet platforms operate within their jurisdictions must be more rights respecting. And so, you know, those assertions of sovereignty, one might, we do look at quite differently. So the report really breaks all of this down and makes a series of recommendations about how to blunt the most dangerous effects of this trend toward digital sovereignty while still respecting freedom of speech.
So Suzanne, let's move on to Iran, where that country is holding presidential elections on Friday, which is today, although we're recording on Thursday. You took part in a panel conversation about the state of human rights in Iran and the state of free expression there with us here at PEN America. What is the current state of play and what's the diplomatic course countries can take to help uphold human rights in Iran?
Yeah, the state of play is quite bleak. You know, we've had what is a government that has called itself reformist, but has really been anything but. Iran is the world's fourth worst jailer of writers on our annual Freedom to Write Index this year. We have a number of signature cases that are really just deeply poignant. Nasreen Sotoudeh is one that I'll highlight, our 2011 Penn Freedom to Write Award winner who has been in and out of prison ever since and has been enduring a really incredible ordeal over the last year and a half with a hunger strike, getting COVID in prison, not getting proper medical care, getting furloughed, getting rearrested, and you know, notwithstanding worldwide opprobrium and outcry, this is a government that really is impervious to its international human rights obligations. And there's a lot of fear that with the election that's just upon us, that things may get even worse. It's a more hardline government that may come in that has a track record of executing, individuals that is beheaded the judiciary, with a track record of executing people for crimes like drinking alcohol. So it's a dire situation, not new, but perhaps on the cusp of even intensifying further in terms of repression. And the question of what the international community can do, I would say a couple of things. You know, one is that, it's always been complex between the U.S. and Iran because of the fraught relationship that Washington and Tehran have had. Obviously, this administration, the Biden administration, is focused on resurrecting the JCPOA, the nuclear deal. That's a top priority. I think it's extremely important that in the course of pursuing that human rights not be sidelined. And we have been pressing for that through an open letter with a coalition of organizations and a whole series of discussions, including our panel discussions that we held yesterday. We see some responsiveness and some stepped up messaging on human rights issues and a firm commitment not to roll back human rights sanctions as part of the give and take of the nuclear deal, which I think is extremely important red line to sustain if the sanctions were imposed in response to individuals' complicity in human rights violations. Progress on the nuclear deal should not play any part in the determination of whether and when those sanctions should be lifted. I think there's more work to be done on the multilateral front. Iran has always been sensitive to global criticism, criticism by United Nations bodies. And so I think the mobilization there is key. I think there needs to be more outreach and dialogue to civil society sectors and independent thinkers inside of Iran. You know, that was a theme that came up in the discussion that we had yesterday, that the level of isolation that those people endure, and the sense that, you know, in the course of this high level diplomatic engagement, that it is, you know, can be almost seem to be forgotten that there's kind of a silent majority or at least large minority within Iran that, you know, for whom this government, whether present or successor, has no legitimacy. This time they have organized a boycott of tomorrow's elections, and, you know, we'll see how widespread that is.
Well, finally, let's turn back to the U.S. This week, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan announced the formation of a campus free speech caucus to help defend against colleges becoming what he called on Fox News, quote, indoctrination camps. It's interesting because his is also the party driving the movement to restrict schools and colleges from teaching so-called divisive topics, including things like critical race theory, which you and I discussed last week, and a topic that we actually gathered a coalition around to write a letter opposing such laws this week. That latter issue around these restrictions for schools seems like a restriction on the First Amendment. You know, is this hypocrisy or is something else going on here?
You know, I think it is hypocrisy. It's not a new variation of hypocrisy. The old, you know, phrase, free speech for me and not for thee, you know, the notion, and, you know, we've seen this increasingly sort of coming from the right, that they hold themselves forth as standard bearers for freedom of expression in the First Amendment. You know, former President Trump used to do that. And at the same time, they go after their critics mercilessly, you know, the president targeting journalists and media organizations. And, you know, this is a great illustration of, you know, precisely that hypocrisy. And at the same time, purporting to be a champion of free speech on campus and be outraged by the censoriousness of, you know, the woke left. And at the same time, you're trying to pass a bill stating that certain ideas should be banned, you know, which we put out a letter just yesterday with about 80 different organizations, many of them academic groups, American Historical Association, Philosophical Association, many other disciplines, objecting and protesting this spate of state-level laws that are purporting to block and prohibit the teaching of critical race theory, often without even any definition of what that is. And so it's very problematic from a First Amendment perspective, from an academic freedom perspective, and we're doing a lot of work to try to call it out for what it is, which is government censorship. Nothing less.
Well, PEN America CEO Suzanne Nossel, let's leave it there. She's author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All, which is out in paperback on July 6th. Thanks, as always, Suzanne.
Thank you, Stephen.
Just a few weeks ago, we at PEN America marked the Day of Crimean Resistance to Russian Occupation, a moment to reflect on Russia's incursion on the peninsula in 2014, and for us to consider the consequences that's had for free expression, cultural freedom, and human rights. Joining me now is Amina Japad, First Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs for Ukraine. She's also been an outspoken advocate of the Crimean Tatar community, particularly under siege since the occupation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Stephen, for welcoming me here.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's been 7 years. I wonder if you can help bring us up to speed a bit on how cultural rights in particular are being curtailed in Crimea now, especially, you know, helping us in the U.S. or elsewhere who might not be hearing about it in the news every day.
Yeah, thank you for your questions. But first, before I go answering your questions about the cultural heritage and the situation with the protection of cultural heritage and cultural rights of those Ukrainian citizens and Ukraine as a state, let me probably inform you a little bit what Crimea is today to those who can listen to us, because of course this is not this piece of paradise for people as Russia today or different Russian mass media trying to show Crimea and Russian officials saying that Russia invests that much money to protect all of those rights of different populations and peoples living in Crimea. But in fact, what I have a strong feeling about, and as the one who used to live in Crimea and as a former journalist who used to work in Crimea and witnessed the occupation and the way how Russia occupied Crimea by my own eyes and kind of by my own skin experienced this, I can say that Crimea is a military base with 2.5 million of Ukrainian citizens as hostages. And probably the most warning situation is taking place with the change of demography. Whereas with this repressive reality, the Ukrainian citizens have been squeezed out from the peninsula. I just as an example, if you, for example, live in Crimea and dare to say that Crimea is Ukrainian, we know that the whole civilized world is pretty much consolidated over the status of Crimea. You can be detained, you can be jailed for 5 years at least, or if you dare to make a Facebook post with an article that says about the Ukrainian status of Crimea, you can also be detained and imprisoned for 5 years. So this is the repressive reality that does not allow to speak up, that does not allow any decent voice to take place. But as an opposite, by squeezing out the Ukrainian citizens, the loyal population for Ukraine, Russia is bringing hundreds of thousands of Russian citizens from the Russian mainland to the Crimean Peninsula. And we have different numbers, even though the official Russian statistics says that it's over 120,000 100,000 of population of newcomers, but the numbers that we can hear from the human rights activists and watchdogs and the Crimean Tatar Majlis, which is a self-governing body, at least 500,000 of newcomers. And of course, this has been done on purpose, and this is a very traditional policy of Russia under different systems of governing, I would say, starting from the first annexation, ending up with the current 2014 situation. So going back to your question and trying to answer that, of course, Ukraine is dealing with the patterns and practices of violations of human rights by occupying power. Situation with the freedom of expression, consciousness, and religion, the right to peaceful assembly and association, freedom of the media and access to the information, the right to a fair trial and effective legal protection, the right to education in one's native language, and linguistic and cultural rights are of particular concern, of course. And we think that Crimean Tatars and Ukrainians constitute probably the most vulnerable groups subjected to human rights violations. Let me bring you an example that in November 2020, the report of the UNESCO Director General, Madame Audrey Azoulay, on the situation in Crimea noted further deterioration of the situation on the peninsula, especially with regards to the protection of the cultural and religious rights of the indigenous peoples. The report directly stresses and says that the problems of preservation of cultural and natural heritage, illegal archaeological research and excavations, and illicit transfer of cultural property. And of course, the UNESCO report noted the deprivation of the education right of ethnic Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars. Just as an example, the education in Ukrainian language decreased 54 times. Only a couple of hundreds of students have an access to the Ukrainian language as such in schools. The Crimean Tatar language in the Crimean Tatar schools, in fact, even though there are formally approximately 14 Crimean Tatar schools, but the language of instruction is Russian. And also probably the warning thing is taking place with the transfers of Crimean artifacts to the show, let's say, to the museums in Russia, in violation of relevant provisions of international law. The Hague Convention, dated 1954, for the protection of cultural property in the event of armed conflict, ratified, by the way, both by Ukraine and Russia, states that parties must prevent any vandalism or misappropriation of cultural property. But the occupying power is required to prevent any export of artifacts from the occupied territory, because this is the property of the state of Ukraine. But we have a drastically opposite situation, where Russian occupying authorities of Crimea continue to conduct illicit large-scale archaeological researches and excavations. More, the consequences I can probably explain if you are interested. Why Crimean Tatars is the purpose of the repressive machinery for centuries, not only in 2014, and what has been taking place with Crimean Tatars for centuries, and why their identity suffers more. So the situation with the Crimean Khan's Palace, probably the last remaining, complete architectural ensemble of the indigenous people, is another example of how very identity of the Crimean Tatar has been threatened. The barbaric so-called reconstruction has been conducted by a team with no experience of working at cultural sites and in a manner that erodes the site's authenticity and historical value, which is precisely as Russia intends, because the Bakhchisarai's Palace is in the tentative list for the UNESCO World Heritage List. And the authenticity of this object is crucial to get and to be included in the UNESCO list. And with the pretext of the so-called renovation and reconstruction, 300-year-old ceramic plates from the rooftop have been taken away, and the new modern Spanish ceramic plates had been put on the rooftop. The wooden bulks also aged 300-400 ages, you know, just barbarically dropped off the roof, and different modern instruments have been used during this so-called reconstruction. So there was no proper and adequate attitude in order to restore the authenticity. But what we heard, that media was actually very vocal, demonstrating this as an act of super renovations, and different, experts and so-called officials of Crimea also publicly spoke up, saying that Russia did something that Ukraine never used to do before, you know, bringing so much money to reconstruct the Crimean Tatar cultural heritage. But in fact, what they did, they destroyed authenticity. And it's very important to understand this kind of context. And another, probably the final point of view to this question, what Crimea is today, is that if anyone of those, let us imagine, who listen to us, would travel to Crimea, probably those can be really impressed with the actively built up infrastructure. You can see roads, you can see an international airport, which is in fact absolutely nothing but domestic Russian airport, because no international flights fly to the Crimean airport. You can see a new hospital, there is a new prison near Bakhchisarai, there are schools, new schools and kindergartens. But if we see the context, why this infrastructure had been built up and for whom this infrastructure has been built up, even the kindergartens and schools, this is, of course, is a military course. The highway road Tavrida that joined Kerch and Sevastopol, both military cities, is actually constructed for the military purpose. The housing for people, for those Russians already transferred to Crimea and their children, the schools and kindergartens for the children of Russian army, and the security services and FSB and those bureaucrats who help to integrate Crimea in this Russian legal space and another reality. So every single step that has been taken in Crimea has a very evident military course. And we have to understand this very probably not visible on the surface context.
I think this is such a helpful way of explaining both the threats to human rights and free expression in Crimea, particularly for Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars. I mean, you also did such an eloquent job of explaining the attempts to erase culture, the attempts to erase history. I'm wondering, it seems so harrowing. What do you see as the positive signs on the ground? What are you seeing from the activists and the writers and the poets and those who are standing up and speaking out on behalf of human rights in Crimea? Is there anything that makes you hopeful?
It's very difficult to find hope within the occupying reality and within the reality that my people, Crimean Tatars and Ukrainian citizens, live in. In this regime of hostages, I will give you one example that I still have my family there. I mean, mm-hmm. Crimean Tatars have big families, and all of them, like my parents, they live in Crimea. My uncles, my aunts, niece, my cousins, they all live in Crimea. And what I've noticed is when they come to visit me in Kyiv, when we discuss different issues, sometimes very distant from politics, they start to whisper. As soon as we touch upon the issues about Crimea, Ukraine, Russia, they start to whisper. Can you imagine this level of, of super high self-censorship? When people discussing those issues, they have this strong feeling of fear so that they can make their voice decrease, they whisper. And I have my first impression, I used to live half a year after the occupation in Crimea, and it was so weird to walk same streets, to see same buildings, but to have a drastically different feeling out of the same reality. I felt myself, walking in a very weird and not native ambiance, not native environment. It was really shocking, and I have a first experience of traveling to the mainland of Ukraine after the occupation, just in a couple of months. I had a couple of meetings in Kyiv, and when I crossed so-called administrative line, I even could sense it with my skin that alias, finally I can breathe. The freedom, the feeling of freedom is super evident as soon as you cross this administrative line. In Crimea, you really have a feeling that you live in a kind of a can, that there is a FSB, like probably same feeling that my parents were talking about where they discussed the Soviet reality, where you have a conspirological feeling that everyone is watching you, that FSB is here. And the reality says that, unfortunately, even in the kindergartens, there are certain people with those functions, to follow the parents who think what, who says what. And this is the reality in Crimea, unfortunately. So it's very, very probably demotivating thing. And within this reality where there is no freedom, there is no room and space for creativity. And also we have very clear and evident acts of repressions where those people who are trying to be resistant and decent, they are detained. But what makes me really, motivated probably or encourage me to keep on do what I'm doing at the moment at my official position is people, is my people, those brave ones, those courageous ones who even within this reality try and find this courageous and courage to keep on inform the whole world about what Crimea is today. There is a platform of resistance called the Crimean Solidarity. These are people with the functions of the civil journalists. So these are average people who take their cell phones, their gadgets, and go to the so-called trials, go and attend the house searches that take place almost every day in Crimea at 5 o'clock in the morning and dawn, where the buses of FSB crush the houses of Crimean Tatars And when after those researchers, people detained and then jailed and then blamed, allegedly called the terrorists. And these people, they take their phones, they're trying to inform us in Ukraine, in Kyiv, in official Kyiv, in world, what is taking place in Crimea. And this is very, very motivating because we have these courageous people. And I remember probably a very personal, let's say, reflection. A couple of months ago, Nariman Mamedyaminov, he's a civil journalist, and he spent 3 years in a prison for the video clip about Islam that he produced in 2013, almost half a year before occupation happened. And he was detained and he was called by the occupying authorities a terrorist. And there was a trial, of course, a decorative trial, I would say. And he spent 3 years in the court. And he said when he was released that the only reason why he was not tortured is the publicity of his case. So in our efforts, in what we do, we always try to bring those names of the political hostages because publicity saves lives. Because when we announce those names in different international forums and the capitals of international organizations, be it Strasbourg, Vienna, New York, Geneva, we save those people.
Absolutely. Well, Amina Jhabbar is First Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister of Ukraine. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. In Crimean Tatar language, it's Sahol.
Sahol.
Thank you.
And that's our episode for Friday, June 18th. Join us next week for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at Pen America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is the Pen Pod. See you soon.